D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
Mit Sibylle Salewski. Vor etwas mehr als 40 Jahren wurde ein Buch veröffentlicht, von dem manche meinen, es sei vielleicht das einflussreichste Buch des 20. Jahrhunderts gewesen. The Limits to Growth, die Grenzen des Wachstums, das war der Titel. In dieser wissenschaftlichen Studie hat eine Gruppe von Forschern des Massachusetts Institutes of Technology zum ersten Mal gezeigt, dass wir nicht so weitermachen können, wie wir das bisher getan haben. Wenn unser Wirtschafts- und Gesellschaftssystem so wachse wie bisher, dann werde das unweigerlich zu einer ganzen Reihe von Umbrüchen und Katastrophen führen. Hunger, Umweltzerstörung, Wirtschaftskollaps. Das, so prophezeiten es die Forscher damals, erwarte uns in den kommenden 100 Jahren, wenn wir nicht umschwenkten. Diese warnende Studie wurde 1972 veröffentlicht. Nun, 40 Jahre später, hat die Volkswagen-Stiftung ein Symposium veranstaltet und gefragt, was aus den Prophezeiungen von damals eigentlich geworden ist. Wir senden bei uns im Hörsaal hier auf D-Radio Wissen die wichtigsten Vorträge und Diskussionen dieses Symposiums. Es hat den Titel Already Beyond – 40 Years Limits to Growth. Stattgefunden hat diese Konferenz am 28. und 29. November 2012 in Hannover. Den Eröffnungsvortrag hat der Hauptverfasser von Die Grenzen des Wachstums gehalten, der amerikanische Ökonom Dennis Meadows.
Good morning, everyone. I'm very happy to be here.
The box that we have created for ourselves is called sustainable development. I'm going to talk about that box today and to try to take your thinking outside so that we can start to have a constructive discussion about what's actually coming. Here are the three main ideas for this talk. First, in 1972, when we first published the project results from the VW-Stiftung Club of Rome project, there were two possible futures for the globe, which I may very approximately call overshoot and sustainable development. To get sustainable development required changes. We didn't make those changes. Instead, at the global level, at the national level, typically also at the municipal level, we pursued growth, and with great success. By and large, as you will see, we managed to double population, industry, and so forth since that first book came out. But the result is that sustainable development is no longer a possible future. We have to look outside that box and examine other possibilities. Two of the urgent tasks will be to start thinking about a lifestyle which uses much less energy and materials. It can still be an attractive lifestyle, but it will be very different. And we need to start increasing the resilience of our systems at all levels. In 1972, our book published a set of pictures about possible futures. Roughly half of those pictures showed overshoot, and half showed some sort of sustainable path. Notice that in 1972, we were still with four decades of growth possible. So in 72, we didn't expect immediate decline. We imagined that only in this century, sometime between 2020, 2040, we would start to see serious problems. Now we are just here. We said in 1972 that if we made really big changes to stop physical growth, we would have the possibility to create a system which could exist for a long time. But we didn't stop physical growth. Here's, for example, a picture of global population. In 1972, we were at about 3.6 billion. We said it's necessary to slow down. You can see our book had enormous influence on global population. Not only population, but also all of the industrial activities. Here is data on the world's use of metals. In 1972, we were here. We said it's necessary to slow down. And of course, things got faster. The result is that the globe is now following the overshoot path, not the sustainable path. And that's confirmed in many ways. For example, recently, the National Research Institute in Australia, CSIRO, the Commonwealth Scientific Industrial Research Organization, studied the last 30 years of history of global development and compared it with all the different scenarios from our book. And as far as one can make these judgments at a global scale, the real data show that we're tracking right along the overshoot path. This work was done in 2000. Recently, they did another 10 years of study and reached the same results. Therefore, we have grown far past the globe's sustainable limits. This concept of carrying capacity is a very difficult one. It depends on many political, technical, biological, and other factors, which we don't understand very well. Probably the best work has been done by Matthias Wackernagel, a Swiss scientist, who tries to understand the globe's total use of energy and materials in comparison with what could be sustained over the long term. He coined the term global ecological footprint, and his calculations show the following. In 1972, when our book came out, the globe was at about 85% of sustainable levels. In those days, it was still possible to imagine slowing down and achieving sustainability. But now we are at about 160% of sustainable levels, and the rate is actually accelerating. It's no longer possible to imagine simply slowing down. We have to get back down. That is politically and economically a totally different kind of challenge. We bring to that challenge, so far, this box called sustainable development. The term, of course, was brought into widespread use through the Brundtland Commission. It put forth the idea that sustainable development is something which meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. Now, this is a definition which politicians love, because it says basically you can have everything you want now, and plus everybody in the future can have what they want. No necessity to make trade-offs. The definition was an advance in that it started to talk, at least, about the connection between the present generation and future generations. But as you see, it assumed that somehow there wasn't a necessary trade-off. I think this was a good starting point in 1987. But now it's not relevant anymore. And in addition, we have begun to add many other ideas to the concept of sustainable development. When you hear a political or a corporate leader today talking about sustainable development, they mean something more. They mean, for example, that the rich should be able to keep what they have, maybe even get more. You don't ever hear any leader talking about sustainable development being a path which is going to reduce the GNP per capita for their own voters. Of course, we recognize that although we should keep what we have, the poor need to come up. It's not fair that there should be so many poor people in the world. So sustainable development obviously means that they can rise to our standards. And the nice thing is, implicitly, we assume this is going to happen without any changes in our current system. The markets, the finance, the politics can remain more or less the same. We're going to find somehow solutions for sustainable development inside the current box. Minor changes in carbon taxes, maybe some feed-in tariffs to promote renewable energy, minor adaptations of the electoral system, but basically it's a current system. And the magical way of doing this will be with new technologies that decouple, they unlink growth from impact on the environment. So we'll continue to have growth, but we're just going to use less and less energy and materials, damage the environment less, and so forth. And the final assumption, which we automatically have these days, is that more growth is going to give us the resources to do all this. It's a fantasy. It's a politically convenient, psychologically reassuring fantasy. I mean, think about it. How suddenly growth, which has caused a lot of problems over the last 40 years, is suddenly going to start solving these problems. If you start to press anybody on this, they are not able to tell you how that's going to happen. Where empirical research has been done, some excellent research has been done in the United Kingdom, for example, we find that this concept of decoupling has no empirical basis. When the GNP goes up, energy and resource use go up. They may go up slightly slower if you're achieving efficiencies, but there's no absolute decoupling. And the myth of technology is easy to see. Most people now understand that we need to reduce CO2 emissions. Indeed, of course, there is in Doha at this moment thousands of people coming together from around the world to understand how that might happen. Despite that we want CO2 to go down, it keeps going up. It's rising now faster than ever before in history. Why? CO2 emissions is a result of four factors. The number of people, the living standard of those people, the amount of capital that they have, their cars, their houses, their beautiful meeting rooms, and so forth. The amount of energy required to operate the capital, and the fraction of that energy which comes from fossil fuels, because combustion of fossil fuels is a principal, not the only, but a principal source of CO2. Germany has been a leader in its concern for climate change. It's a leader in its implementation of renewable energy. What's happened is there have been enormous efforts and some success to increase efficiency and to shift from fossil to non-fossil energy sources. But consider that the number of people is outside our control, and we take it as a matter of faith that the living standard has to keep going up. When you overlook population and living standard growth and focus only on efficiency and renewables, you have no possibility to stop the growth of CO2. We haven't managed to do it so far, and we're not going to do it in the future until we begin to focus more on the social, the demographic, and the cultural factors. So what? Well, then, because we haven't done this, we need to understand that we're moving into a period which is going to see a great deal more change. We will look back 20 or 30 years from now on this period from 1950 up to 2000 as having been unusually calm, unusually supportive of growth and progress. We're moving into a period of intense climate change. This is a computer-generated graph of the world in the period 2030 to 2039. These things are quite uncertain, of course, but they're better than simply guessing about it. And they show the areas in dark red and black as intense drought. I actually fished this map off the web when I was speaking in Russia. I wanted to try and get the Russians to start taking climate change seriously. A hopeless effort, I must say, but that's what I was trying to do. And I said to them, you know, you have two choices. You can either start worrying about climate change, or you can start learning Chinese. This area in China produces 65% of China's grain. And if it becomes impossible to produce much agriculture there, those Chinese are going to move up into the region, which is still relatively well watered. They're doing it already. But as I looked at the graph, I could see that I better start learning Spanish, because also this area in Spain, or in Mexico, is producing a lot of food, and it's going to become difficult. So we're going to start seeing a lot of change. Even the Wall Street Journal starts to talk now about volatility. This is from last week's front page of the second section. And you see it in the data. If you collect information on natural disasters from 1900 up to 2010, you see that we're in a period of rapid change. So what? Well, it means that we need to work as hard as we can to reduce climate change. We need to work as hard as we can to find alternative energy sources. But we have to recognize that we're not going to maintain what we have, and that we're moving into a period of enormous unsettlement and change. It gives really two priorities. One is to start thinking about lifestyles which have much less energy and material use. That's actually an interesting and positive opportunity. Sometime on a piece of paper, list the four or five things that make you most happy. Love, health, self-understanding, the ability to walk down a street at night without worrying about your personal safety. These are the things which are important to people, and in most cases, they don't require a lot of energy and materials. If we can restructure our governance systems to start pursuing those things instead of simply blindly and endlessly trying to expand the GNP, I think we can achieve both improved welfare as well as drastic reductions. The second urgent task is to start thinking about the concept of resilience. Preparing our systems all the way from the home, the family, the organization, the city, and up to survive and prosper under periods of intense shock. Resilience is the ability to absorb a shock quickly and to regain the ability to perform essential functions. New York City now, for the first time, starts to think about this concept of resilience. If the system continues to perform after the shock, we say it's stable. If it stops but then springs back, we say it's flexible. There are ways to assess the flexibility of our current systems and ways to increase them. Some of those ways cost a lot, and some of them cost practically nothing at all. It simply requires that you ask the question. That will be an area of great profit. And we need to get started because we have been in a period where there has been a strong pursuit of efficiency, profit. And it's unfortunately the case that when you increase the efficiency of a system, trying to maximize its short-term results, you tend to reduce its resilience. The Japanese industry found that out. The most efficient way to produce a particular part for an automobile is to create one factory someplace which produces all of those parts for all cars in the world. It's very efficient, but if you have a Fukushima, which eliminates the factory from operation, or if you have, for example, a flood in Thailand, which inundates a factory which is very efficient at producing computer hard drives, then suddenly the system appears to be quite brittle. We need now to start thinking how we can move from out here back into this region, relatively good efficiency, but with a great deal more resilience. That, I think, is a challenge for the next 40 years. And if we can simply quit being preoccupied with sustainable development, then for sure there are many interesting things to do. Thank you.
Das war der amerikanische Ökonom Dennis Meadows über die Auswirkungen der Studie Die Grenzen des Wachstums, die Meadows zusammen mit Kollegen vom Massachusetts Institute of Technology verfasst hat. Meadows hat diesen Vortrag beim Herrenhäuser-Symposium der Volkswagen-Stiftung am 28. November 2012 gehalten. Zu Meadows Eröffnungsvortrag gab es ein kommentierendes Co-Referat des Soziologen Harald Welzer. Im Anschluss daran haben Meadows und Welzer in einer Podiumsdiskussion Fragen aus dem Publikum beantwortet. Moderiert hat die Veranstaltung der Chefredakteur der Zeitschrift Geo, Martin Meister.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
Thank you very much, Dennis Meadows, for this brilliant presentation, and thank you, the organizers, for inviting me and giving me the honor to comment on this talk and first presentation of this day here. And I mean, it is a very difficult task because there were two elements in this presentation here that make it really difficult to comment. The first thing, of course, is that this was a kind of a particular presentation right in the beginning of the conference, yes? And I'm very curious how this will be absorbed during today and the next day, because the message is clear. We are already beyond the sustainable path. We move into a very different direction, and I think societies of our type or cultures of our type still don't have any concept to confront themselves with messages like this, because we are in a model that thinks that our type of making a living, our type of production is unlimited. It will stay forever. And the scandal that the limits to growth put in 1972 was exactly this, that there were two keywords. One was limit and the other thing was growth. That is exactly the opposite of what is at the heart of modernity, because the heart of modernity is overcoming limitations. And the attempt to achieve this overcoming of limitations is growth economy. So those were exactly the two words that were completely against everything that was the cultural belief at that time and still is. So I think this example that happened 40 years ago and is still going on is the classical thing that there is enlightenment versus faith. Because modernity in this way established a faith system, and anyone who says that this is limited, the project is in itself an impossible one, is against the faith of modernity. And I think this is the impact, the psychological and social psychological impact of the limits to growth. And I only want to add a few things to what Dennis Meadows just presented and maybe go into a very brief discussion of the concept of resilience in this respect. I want to add one factor, that we talk about a cultural and political and social and economic system that was extremely successful. The most successful system we had in history. In 200 years, extreme progress was achieved, like in establishing democracy in many societies, establishing free societies, legal states, education system, health systems, things like that. And on the other hand, we had this enormous increase in wealth and all kind of material things. And I think we are now in the moment, or maybe we have been already in 1972 in the moment, to think about how this civilizatory standard that was achieved by this type of Western capitalism, how this civilizatory standard can be kept, can be that we can hold on this, and at the same time reduce all material consumption, all energy consumption, all emissions to a level that life is still possible. And what is missing in all debates about climate and the ecological problems and things like that is a perspective towards the future and how civilizatory standards can be kept. Because we always talk about the status quo and how this can be kept like it is, which is, of course, impossible, as Dennis just brilliantly showed to us, and as any figures show. I have here, I'm not the PowerPoint person, I have just some additional slides, and I don't have to comment on this because it just illustrates what was already said. The extractions of minerals, and in the curve that goes up in the same way as it was illustrated, North American extraction and the increase over the last 25 or 30 years, and the energy consumption on the world level, you always see the same curve, and there's no change in the whole thing. But this is not that I want to go very much deeply into this, because we always see the same curve, and there is not a single exception in it. So I want to go a little bit more into the cultural factors. This I found recently. This was a game that we played when we were kids. It's called Öl für uns alle. I don't know if this was also a game in America or whatever. This was invented by British Petrol and then taken over by Ravensburger because it was so extremely successful, this game. And this shows that we are not talking about scientific concepts or cognitive approaches to this, but we talk also about a cultural model that is deeply inside of our minds, inside of our habits and all these things. So a society, to imagine a society that goes into a different direction, not being an expansive society anymore, but a reductive society, is something that is completely new to us. And again, to how to become a reductive society, how to develop a reductive modernity that keeps the civilizatory standards without using all these materials. That is the task we have. And I found yesterday in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung this very interesting article in the context of Doha from Heike Schröder from the University of East Anglia, who did a study about the growth in the international climate conferences. And this is a change in size of national delegations from COP1 to COP17, which is quite interesting. If you look at the numbers of delegates in the conferences, in the international climate conferences, you have these beautiful numbers. From 1995 in Berlin, 757 delegates, to now in Doha, 17,000 delegates, and 7,000 from the NGOs, and 1,500 from the press, which is quite interesting, because what does it show? The development of the 40 years since the first publication of The Limits to Growth shows a perfect adaptation of this Western capitalist system, that it can take everything inside by the mode of division of labor, by functional differentiation. What was established during the last 40 years was a kind of concern industry of people who are professionally concerned about what will happen in the future. And this is, of course, an industry with perfect growth numbers, with growth rates, so no limits to growth in this respect. But this is, of course, something one has to take into the reflection, into consideration, when we talk about this fact that Dennis just mentioned, that it's impossible to reduce CO2 emissions and all these other things only by technical factors and only by heightening energy efficiency. And again, from a historical point of view, you can say that the heightening of efficiency is at the heart of capitalist production, because without the constant heightening of efficiency, nothing would have been achieved through this last 200 years. So heightening this, again, is not a solution at all. Now, talking about resilience, I think it's a very crucial point that societies of our type and all the other societies have to talk about resilience, how to become more resilient facing the stress and all this pressing factors that will come up within the next years and decades. But how to do this? In the short pre-paper that you sent me, there was some kind of trust in scientific measurements to heighten resilience. I don't think that this will work. I think what we need to develop something like a culture of resilience is the reinvention or the re-import of the category of future. Because resilience is a social means to be able to live in the future. And our whole discussion about sustainability, about climate change, about all these things is taking place without mentioning a future that looks different from the present. So to establish cultural practices, social modes, social means to become more resilient needs at the first place that we have to discuss of how a future should look like. And in a positive way, not only in a negative way, because we are used to this negative thing. We have to reduce CO2 emissions. We have to reduce the extraction numbers and all these things. But there is no goal. There is no positive formulation about the type of society, the type of life we want to live in. So I think the step to have something like a resilience culture, to develop something like this, and nobody knows how to do this exactly, needs a political discussion about what is the type of society, what is the type of culture we want to live in. So it's something like a reverse type of discussion. I don't know if this will save the world. I would doubt it, but it's worth, I think, the attempt to try to do this. And the task is, again, to make a transformation from an expansive modernity to a reductive modernity. And to talk about this, we need something like a reinvention of visions of a possible future that keeps the civilizatory standard but looks totally different in terms of consumerism, wealth, and things like that. Thank you very much.
Well, Dr. Meadows, that was quite a shock this morning. You said goodbye to the concept of sustainability. And what options are left to us if it's not sustainable development?
I mentioned two priorities. One is basically elaborating on Harold's ideas to start thinking about what sort of future we want and can have. It will be a future which puts more emphasis on social, psychological, and cultural factors and less emphasis on the consumption of energy and material. There are many ways to get started on that. Now, there is quite a significant effort around the world to find indicators that will be used in addition to GNP calculations, such things like gross national happiness, the national development indicator, the first being used in Bhutan, the second being defined by United Nations agencies. Important to do that here, I said during my talk. It's very useful to sit down and make a list of the things which make you personally very happy. When you do that, you find that many of them don't require you to buy a new car or more clothes or a better watch. They require you to spend more time with your family or your friends or yourself. They consume less energy material. So there's many things to do in that area. The second urgent task is resilience. In my slides, I laid out a systematic way of beginning to evaluate how resilient is a particular system, identifying what shocks could occur, how big, over what time period, looking for synergies, and so forth. And then going down the list of ways to increase the ability to withstand those shocks. I've done that with my own household. I'm doing it now with my town. You can do it with an organization. This is something which can be enacted at every level. And the nice thing is, when you begin to do things which make a system more resilient, a side benefit is it becomes also more sustainable.
Well, this still sounds quite abstract to me, this new wonder word, resilience. I just take this question, the first that comes to my eyes here. Somebody from the audience says, I have the impression that there is an inflation of concepts, not with the new concept of resilience. to give an impression of movement. What is the difference between resilience and sustainable development?
When you talk about the future and start to discuss actions which haven't been taken yet, I'm sorry, it is abstract. I don't know how to get around that. But I don't think resilience is especially guilty of this. I recently wrote a preface for a book on sustainable development, and the author of that book said that there are over 1,000 definitions of sustainable development. So, I mean, there is even exponential growth in the way we talk about sustainable development. What's the difference between sustainable development and resilience? Well, a profound difference. The way we use the term sustainable development assumes order, assumes the current system will suffice. When we talk about resilience, you are assuming there's going to be disorder, chaos, shocks, and it recognizes that the current system isn't going to work very well. I don't know, of course, what's happening in the future precisely. But when I look at my curves, I'm absolutely sure that we are going to see enormous change. And I don't mean in the abstract. Even here in Hanover, in the next 30 years, you will see bigger changes in government, in your environment, in your economic structures than you have seen in the last 100. Since the time when Germany was under the Kaiser until now, less has changed than you will see in the next 30 years. Preparing for that means resilience. It doesn't mean starting from the assumption of sustainable development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something to this. It is absolutely different, sustainability and resilience, because resilience is something that is out of the box in terms of the ways modern societies cope with problems and solve problems, because they solve problems by using technical equipment or by having expansive strategies to solve problems. Resilience is something totally different. It is a preparation for disastrous situations and the development of social modes and techniques to cope with disasters. There's a very interesting study by Greg Bankoff, Cultures of Disasters, and this he investigates the Philippines and other societies who are very used to disasters, and he is investigating the social strategies, how people cope with these disasters and can survive even after the disaster by having these kind of social strategies to do. In our type of societies that are extremely vulnerable because everything is delegated to institutions and to technical means and things like that, nobody knows how to cope with a disaster. Everybody is completely helpless in a situation. We saw this in New York and Sandy a few weeks ago. There was a report in the Frankfurter Allgemeine, the experience of this when there is no electricity in a city like New York. What is when the elevators don't go up? What is when the heating doesn't work because it's electric? Things like that. So it's just the extreme amount of vulnerability in this type of society, and resilience would be a concept that tries to get rid of this amount of vulnerability. This is the thing.
Okay. How to communicate in an intelligent way to the global community that sustainable development is a myth? Well, how can you organize your communication? How can it spread?
A basic law of behavior is that you don't respond to something about which you have no information. So the first thing is to start gathering data about some aspects that we currently ignore. We are so focused on GNP, and for example, even in Germany, which is quite successful in respect, we don't have systematic data, which is widely used, on the quality of interpersonal relationships or the level of personal satisfaction or the sense of security when walking outside your house. So there are so many things which make us happy and which would make us excited if we thought we could achieve them in the future where we don't have information. A way to get started is simply by defining new data schemes to do this. I used to do a lot of corporate consulting, and often we found that the company leaders had to change their behavior. Again and again, we found the simplest way was simply to give them new information about what was going on. They don't have to change their values. They don't have to become new people. They only have to understand things in a different way. And that often is possible simply by giving them information which already exists someplace. You need to make it available where the action is.
But can't you give us some ideas how to organize this process? Let's say in the field of governance, for example, there's a question here for that. What does just and democratic governance look like through periods of increasing volatility? How to organize all this? We can't wait for another 10 years for more data, can we?
So, of course, I have to point out two things. First of all, nobody knows the answer to those things. And if they did, they wouldn't be able to give you a one-minute answer to the question. The important thing is to start asking the questions. Herman Daly is a very famous equilibrium economist, and he says, don't expect to know all the answers before you start the trip. Take the first step, and in the process, you will learn how to take the second step. It's going to be the same way for us with our future.
Which are the three things that should all of us change today, all of us in this room, change today to have or to promote a more sustainable lifestyle, or let's say a more resilient lifestyle for that matter?
So let me be realistic here. There aren't three simple rules. Life isn't like that. If you sit down with a person and understand something about their economic, their social circumstances, their professional activities, the quality of the relationship they have in their family, then you can begin to understand what they should do. But there's no, I wouldn't put on a flip chart three rules, to success for sustainability. But I'll give sort of two guidelines. One is try to understand how you can strengthen the social side of your life, your personal relationship, your social networks, the friends that you have, how the interchange there can start to substitute for material consumption. And the second is to become more aware of what's actually flowing through your life, the materials and the energy, and asking yourself the question, where can you cut down? I give a very stupid and simple example, but just to be concrete. Recently, I was in Germany, actually in Bremerhaven, on a panel with a German colleague, and someone in the audience stood up and asked this question, what can we do? And I said, start to think about your consumption. And then I said to my friend, show them your watch. So he held out his watch. And I showed them my watch. And then I said to my friend, how much did your watch cost? 11,000 euros.
And I said, friends.
12 euros. Just to pay attention, and when you pay attention, often you will find it's possible to use much less materials and energy for the same satisfaction.
All right, Dennis Mendoza, I think we got the message.
I want all of you who are wearing 11,000 euro watches after this program to get rid of them and buy a 12-euro watch. And then we will make a small step towards sustainability.
All right. Thanks. The last word for Harald Welzer.
Yeah, only one attempt to answer this three steps question. I think the first step is to get rid of the illusions, to take this first talk of this conference seriously, to take seriously that we are not in the situation anymore where we can continue even scientifically to do business as usual, to gather data on the conditions of the Earth and whatever. I mean, what we always ask from our students and what pupils are asked in school is to make transfers from their knowledge to their practices. What we don't do in the mode we deal with the problems is doing these transfers. We don't do this. All the guys from the climate research departments, they provide all kinds of catastrophic data, but they don't draw consequences out of it. I was at a conference 2 years ago or something like this, an open space conference. It was quite interesting. There was a climate researcher from Great Britain who offered a workshop under the title, "What If We Fail?" Others offered workshops on new measures and data gathering and things like that. So there were just two people who attended this workshop, "What If We Fail?" The guy who made this proposal and me. And nobody else was interested in this. But this is because we are part of the problem in the mode that we think we can go on even on the professional level and ignoring the impact of the message that Dennis and others tell us. So we are part of the illusionary, superficial dealing with the problem, and I think it's a very good step to step out of the box.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Meadows, Dr. Welzer. Thank you, dear audience. And now we go for the coffee break.
Der Soziologe Harald Welzer und der Ökonom Dennis Meadows haben über die Auswirkungen der Studie Die Grenzen des Wachstums diskutiert. Die Veranstaltung war Teil des Herrenhäuser-Symposiums der Volkswagen-Stiftung und fand am 28. November 2012 in Hannover statt.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.